body and biological response would direct him to avoid causing harm to others. On a large scale, others are abstract items. Given the lack of social contact with the people concerned, the civil servant's brain leads rather than his emotions, with numbers, spreadsheets, statistics, more spreadsheets, and theories. When I expressed this idea to my co-author, Mark Blythe, he blurted out the obvious. Stalin could not have existed in a municipality. Small is beautiful in so many other ways. Take for now that the small, in the aggregate, that is, a collection of small units, is more anti-fragile than the large. In fact, the large is doomed to breaking, a mathematical property we will explain later that sadly seems universal as it applies to large corporations, very large mammals, and large administrations. It is quite distressing to hear debates about political systems that make comparisons between countries when the size of the entities is not the same. Say, comparing Singapore to Malaysia. The size of the unit may matter more than the system. There is another issue with the abstract state, a psychological one. We humans scorn what is not concrete. We are more easily swayed by a crying baby than by thousands of people dying elsewhere that do not make it to our living room through the TV set. The one case is a tragedy, the other a statistic. Our emotional energy is blind to probability. The media make things worse as they play on our infatuation with anecdotes, our thirst for the sensational, and they cause a great deal of unfairness that way. At the present time, one person is dying of diabetes every 7 seconds, but the news can only talk about victims of hurricanes with houses flying in the air. The problem is that by creating bureaucracies, we put civil servants in a position to make decisions based on abstract and theoretical matters, with the illusion that they will be making them in a rational, accountable way. Also consider that lobbyists, this annoying race of lobbyists, cannot exist in a municipality or small region. The Europeans, thanks to the centralization of some power with the European Commission in Brussels, are quickly discovering the existence of these mutants coming to manipulate democracy for the sake of some large corporation. By influencing one single decision or regulation in Brussels, a single lobbyist gets a large bang. It is a much larger payoff at low cost than with municipalities, which would require armies of lobbyists trying to convince people while embedded in their communities. Thankfully, the European Union is legally protected from over-centralization thanks to the principle of subsidiarity. Things should be handled by the smallest possible unit that can manage them with efficacy. The idea was inherited from the Catholic Church. Philosophically, a unit doesn't need to be very large, the state, nor very small, the individual, but somewhere in between. This is a powerful philosophical statement, particularly in light of both the transfers of fragility we saw in Chapter 4 and the notion that size fragilizes, much on which later. Consider, too, the other effect of scale. Small corporations are less likely to have lobbyists. The same bottom-up effect applies to law. The Italian political and legal philosopher Bruno Leone has argued in favor of the robustness of judge-based law, owing to its diversity, as compared to explicit and rigid codifications. True, the choice of a court could be a lottery, but it helps prevent large-scale mistakes. I use the example of Switzerland to show the natural anti-fragility of political systems and how stability is achieved by managing noise, having a mechanism for letting it run its natural course, not by minimizing it. Note another element of Switzerland. It is perhaps the most successful country in history, yet it has traditionally had a very low level of university education compared to the rest of the rich nations. Its system, even in banking during my days, was based on apprenticeship models, nearly vocational rather than theoretical ones. In other words, on techne, crafts and know-how, not episteme, book knowledge, know-what. Away from Extremistan. Let us now examine the technical aspects of the process, a more statistical view of the effect of human intervention on the volatility of affairs. There is a certain mathematical property to this bottom-up volatility, and to the volatility of natural systems. It generates the kind of randomness I call mediocristan. Plenty of variations that might be scary, but tend to cancel out in the aggregate, over time or over the collection of municipalities that constitute the larger confederation or entity, rather than the unruly one called extremistan, in which you have mostly stability and occasionally large chaos. Errors there have large consequences. One fluctuates, the other jumps. One has a lot of small variations, the other varies in lumps. Just like the income of the driver compared to that of bank employee, the two types of randomness are qualitatively distinct. Mediocristan has a lot of variations, not a single one of which is extreme. Extremistan has few variations, but those that take place are extreme. Another way to understand the difference. Your caloric intake is from mediocristan. If you add the calories you consume in a year, even without adjusting for your lies, not a single day will represent much of the total, say more than 0.5% of the total, 5,000 calories when you may consume 800,000 in a year. So the exception, the rare event, plays an inconsequential role in the aggregate and the long term. You cannot double your weight in a single day, not even a month, not possibly in a year, but you can double your net worth or lose half of it in a single moment. By comparison, if you take the sale of novels, more than half of sales and perhaps 90% of profits tends to come from the top 0.1%. So the exception, the 1 in 1,000 event, is dominant there. So financial matters and other economic matters tend to be from extremistan, just like history, which moves by discontinuities and jumps from one state to another. When randomness gets distributed across a large number of small units, along with small recurrent political disorder, we get the first type, the benign mediocristan. When randomness concentrates, we get the second type, the sneaky extremistan. Graphic 2 of your PDF file illustrates how antifragile systems are hurt when they are deprived of their natural variations, mostly thanks to naive intervention. Beyond municipal noise, the same logic applies to the child who, after spending time in a sterilized environment, is left out in the open. A system with dictated political stability from the top. The effects of price controls. The advantages of size for a corporation, etc. We switch from a system that produces steady but controllable volatility, mediocristan, closer to the statistical bell curve, from the benign family of the Gaussian or normal distribution, into one that is highly unpredictable and moves mostly by jumps, called fat tails. Fat tails, a synonym for extremistan, mean that remote events, those in what is called the tails, play a disproportionate role. One, the first graph in graphic 2, is volatile. It fluctuates but does not sink. The other, the second graph in graphic 2, sinks without significant fluctuations outside the episodes of turmoil. In the long run, the second system will be far more volatile, but volatility comes in lumps. When we constrain the first system, we tend to get the second outcome. Note also that in extremistan, predictability is very low. In the second, pseudo-smooth kind of randomness, mistakes appear to be rare, but they will be large, often devastating when they occur. Actually, an argument we develop in Book 4, anything locked into planning tends to fail precisely because of these attributes. It is quite a myth that planning helps corporations. In fact, we saw that the world is too random and unpredictable to base a policy on visibility of the future. What survives comes from the interplay of some fitness and environmental conditions. The Great Turkey Problem. Let me now move back from the technical jargon and graphs of fat tails and extremistan to colloquial Lebanese. In extremistan, one is prone to be fooled by the properties of the past and get the story exactly backwards. It is easy, looking at what is happening in the second graph of graphic 2, before the big jump down, to believe that the system is now safe, particularly when the system has made a progressive switch from the scary type of visibly volatile randomness it left to the apparently safe right. It looks like a drop in volatility, and it is not. A turkey is fed for 1,000 days by a butcher. Every day confirms to its staff of analysts that butchers love turkeys with increased statistical confidence. The butcher will keep feeding the turkey until a few days before Thanksgiving. Then comes the day when it is really not a very good idea to be a turkey. So, with the butcher surprising it, the turkey will have a revision of belief, right when its confidence in the statement that the butcher loves turkeys is maximal and it is very quiet and soothingly predictable in the life of the turkey. This example builds on an adaptation of a metaphor by Bertrand Russell. The key here is that such a surprise will be a black swan event, but just for the turkey, not for the butcher. We can also see from the turkey story the mother of all harmful mistakes. Mistaking absence of evidence of harm for evidence of absence, a mistake that we will see tends to prevail in intellectual circles and one that is grounded in the social sciences. So our mission in life becomes simply how not to be a turkey, or, if possible, how to be a turkey in reverse, anti-fragile, that is. Not being a turkey starts with figuring out the difference between true and manufactured stability. Likewise, before the events known as the Arab Spring of 2011, we were duped by Egypt and Syria, and are, as I am writing this, fooled by Saudi Arabia, about which a bit later. The reader can easily imagine what happens when constrained, volatility-choked systems explode. We have a fitting example: the removal of the Ba'ath Party, with the abrupt toppling of Saddam Hussein and his regime in 2003 by the United States. More than 100,000 persons died, and 10 years later, the place is still a mess. 12,000 years. We started the discussion of the state with the example of Switzerland. Now let us go a little bit farther east. The northern Levant, roughly today's northern part of Syria and Lebanon, stayed perhaps the most prosperous province in the history of mankind over the long, very long stretch of time from the pre-pottery Neolithic until very modern history, the middle of the 20th century. That's 12,000 years compared to, say, England, which has been prosperous for about 500 years, or Scandinavia, now only prosperous for less than 300 years. Few areas on the planet have managed to thrive with so much continuity over any protracted stretch of time, what historians call longue durée. Other cities came and went: Aleppo, Emesa, today Homs, and Laodicea, Latakia, stayed relatively affluent. The northern Levant was since ancient times dominated by traders, largely owing to its position as a central spot on the Silk Road, and by agricultural lords, as the province supplied wheat to much of the Mediterranean world, particularly Rome. The area supplied a few Roman emperors, a few Catholic popes before the schisms, and more than 30 Greek-language writers and philosophers, which includes many of the heads of Plato's Academy, in addition to the ancestors of the American visionary and computer entrepreneur Steve Jobs, who brought us the Apple computer, on one of which I am recopying these lines, and the iPad tablet, on which you may be reading them. We know of the autonomy of the province from the records during Roman days, as it was then managed by the local elites, a decentralized method of ruling through locals that the Ottoman retained. Cities minted their own coins. Then two events took place. First, after the Great War, one part of the northern Levant was integrated into the newly created nation of Syria, separated from its other section, now part of Lebanon. The entire area had been until then part of the Ottoman Empire, but functioned as somewhat autonomous regions. Ottomans, like the Romans before them, let local elites run the place so long as sufficient tax was paid, while they focused on their business of war. The Ottoman type of imperial peace, the Pax Ottomana, like its predecessor, the Pax Romana, was good for commerce. Contracts were enforced, and that is what governments are needed for the most. In the recent nostalgic book Levant, Philip Mansell documents how the cities of the Eastern Mediterranean operated as city-states, separated from the hinterland. Then, a few decades into the life of Syria, the modernist Ba'ath Party came to further enforce utopias. As soon as the Ba'athists centralized the place and enforced their status laws, Aleppo and Emesa went into instant decline. What the Ba'ath Party did in its modernization program was to remove the archaic mess of the souks and replace them with the crisp modernism of the office building. The effect was immediately visible. Overnight, the trading families moved to places such as New York and New Jersey for the Jews, California for the Armenians, and Beirut for the Christians. Beirut offered a commerce-friendly atmosphere, and Lebanon was a benign, smaller, disorganized state without any real central government. Lebanon was small enough to be a municipality on its own. It was smaller than a medium-sized metropolitan area. War, prison, or both. But while Lebanon had all the right qualities, the state was too loose, and by allowing the various Palestinian factions to own weapons, it caused an arms race between the communities while placidly watching the entire buildup. Disorganized is invigorating, but the Lebanese state was one step too disorganized. It would be like allowing each of the New York mafia bosses to have a larger army than the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Just imagine John Gotti with missiles. So in 1975, a raging civil war started in Lebanon. A sentence that still shocks me when I think about it was voiced by one of my grandfather's friends, a wealthy Aleppan merchant who fled the Ba'ath regime. When my grandfather asked his friend during the Lebanese war why he did not go back to Aleppo, his answer was categorical. "We people of Aleppo prefer war to prison." I thought he meant that they were going to put him in jail, but then I realized that by prison, he meant the loss of political and economic freedoms. Economic life, too, seems to prefer war to prison. Lebanon and northern Syria had very similar wealth per individual, what economists call gross domestic product, about a century ago, and had identical cultures, language, ethnicities, food, and even jokes. Everything was the same, except for the rule of the modernizing Ba'ath Party in Syria, compared to the totally benign state in Lebanon. In spite of a civil war that decimated the population, causing an acute brain drain and setting wealth back by several decades, in addition to every possible form of chaos that rocked the place, today Lebanon has a considerably higher standard of living, between 3 and 6 times the wealth of Syria. Nor did the point escape Machiavelli. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote, citing him, "It seemed," wrote Machiavelli, "that in the midst of murders and civil wars, our republic became stronger and its citizens infused with virtues. A little bit of agitation gives resources to souls, and what makes the species prosper isn't peace, but freedom." Pax Romana. The centralized nation-state is not exactly new in history. In fact, it existed in a nearly identical form in ancient Egypt. But this was an isolated event in history, and it did not survive there for long. The Egyptian high state started collapsing upon contact with the crazy, unruly, barbaric, disorganized, harassing invaders coming from Asia Minor with their assault chariots, literally a killer app. The dynasties of ancient Egypt did not run the place like an empire, but like an integrated state, which is markedly different. As we saw, it produces different types of variations. Nation-states rely on centralized bureaucracy, whereas empires, such as the Roman Empire and Ottoman dynasties, have relied on local elites, in fact allowing the city-states to prosper and conserve some effective autonomy, and, what was great for peace, such autonomy was commercial, not military. In reality, the Ottomans did these vassals and suzerains a favor by preventing them from involvement in warfare. This took away militaristic temptations and helped them thrive. Regardless of how iniquitous the system seemed to be on the surface, it allowed locals to focus on commerce rather than war. It protected them from themselves. This is the argument brought by David Hume in his History of England in favor of small states as large states get tempted by warfare. Clearly, neither the Romans nor the Ottomans were allowing local autonomy out of love of freedom on the part of others. They just did it for convenience. A combination of empire for some affairs and semi-independent regions, left alone for their own business, provides more stability than the middle, a centralized nation-state with flags and discrete borders. But the states, even when centralized, as in Egypt or China, were, in practice, not too different from the Roman and Ottoman ones, except for the centralization of intellect with the scribes and the Mandarinate system establishing a monopoly of knowledge. Some of us may remember that there were days with no internet, no electronic monitoring of wire transfers to supervise tax receipts, and before modernity's communication networks, with the telegraph, the train, and later the telephone, states had to rely on messenger services. So a local provincial ruler was king for a large number of matters, even though he was not so nominally. Until recent history, the central state represented about 5% of the economy, compared to about 10 times that share in modern Europe. And further, governments were sufficiently distracted by war to leave economic affairs to businessmen. Note that people invoke an expression, Balkanization, about the mess created by fragmented states, as if fragmentation was a bad thing, and as if there was an alternative in the Balkans. But nobody uses Helvetization to describe its successes. War or no war? Let us take a look at Europe before the creations of the nation-states of Germany and Italy, marketed as reunification, as if these nations had been crisp units in some romantic past. There were, until the creation of these romantic entities, a fissiparous and amorphous mass of small statelings and city-states in constant tension, but shifting alliances. In most of their history, Genoa and Venice were competing for the eastern and southern Mediterranean, like two hookers battling for a sidewalk. And here is something comforting about statelings at war. Mediocrity cannot handle more than one enemy, so war here turns into an alliance there. Tension was always present somewhere, but without large consequences, like precipitation in the British Isles. Mild rain and no floods are vastly more manageable than the opposite. Long droughts followed by intense rainfall. In other words, mediocristan. Then, of course, the contagious creation of nation-states in the late 19th century led to what we saw with the two world wars and their sequels, more than 60 million and possibly 80 million victims. The difference between war and no war became huge, with marked discontinuity. This is no different from a switch to winner-take-all effects in industry, the domination of rare events. A collection of statelings is similar to the restaurant business we discussed earlier. Volatile, but you never have a generalized restaurant crisis, unlike, say, the banking business. Why? Because it is composed of a lot of independent and competing small units that do not individually threaten the system and make it jump from one state to another. Randomness is distributed rather than concentrated. Some people have fallen for the naive turkey-style belief that the world is getting safer and safer, and of course they naively attribute it to the holy state, though bottom-up Switzerland has about the lowest rate of violence of any place on the planet. It is exactly like saying that nuclear bombs are safer because they explode less often. The world is subjected to fewer and fewer acts of violence, while wars have the potential to be more criminal. We were very close to the mother of all catastrophes in the 1960s, when the United States was about to pull the nuclear trigger on the Soviet Union. Very close. When we look at risks in Extremistan, we don't look at evidence. Evidence comes too late. We look at potential damage. Never has the world been more prone to more damage. Never. A more rigorous reading of the data, with appropriate adjustment for the unseen, shows that a war that would decimate the planet would be completely consistent with the statistics and would not even be an outlier. As we will see, Ben Bernanke was similarly fooled with his great moderation, a turkey problem. One can be confused by the properties of any process with compressed volatility from the top. Some people, like Steve Pinker, misread the nature of the statistical process and hold such a thesis, similar to the great moderation, in finance. It is hard to explain to naive data-driven people that risk is in the future, not in the past. The messy multi-ethnic empire, the so-called Austro-Hungarian Empire, vanished after the Great War, along with its Ottoman neighbor and rival, and to a large extent, sibling. Don't tell them. to be replaced with crisp, clean nation-states. The Ottoman Empire, with its messy nationalities, or rather what was left of it, became the state of Turkey, modeled after Switzerland, with nobody noticing the inconsistency. Vienna became trapped in Austria, with whom it shared very little outside the formal language. Imagine moving New York City to central Texas and still calling it New York. Stefan Zweig, the Viennese Jewish novelist, then considered the most influential author in the world, expressed his pain in the poignant memoir The World of Yesterday. Vienna joined the league of multicultural cities such as Alexandria, Smyrna, Aleppo, Prague, Thessaloniki, Constantinople, now Istanbul, and Trieste, now squeezed into the Procrustean bed of the nation-state, with its citizens left in the grip of intergenerational nostalgia. Unable to handle the loss and integrate elsewhere, Zweig later committed suicide in Brazil. I first read his account as I was put in a similar situation of physical and cultural exile when my Levantine Christian world was shattered by the Lebanese War, and I wondered whether he might have stayed alive had he gone to New York instead. Chapter 6. Systems That Like Randomness explains the effect of overstabilizing organisms in complex systems, political, economic, etc. The defects of intellectualism. U.S. foreign policy and pseudo-stabilization. Tell them I love some randomness. Maxwell and Extremistan. Complicated mechanisms to feed a donkey. Virgil said to do it, and do it now. The point of the previous chapter was that the risk properties of the first brother, the fragile bank employee, are vastly different from those of the second one, the comparatively anti-fragile artisan taxi driver. Likewise, the risk characteristic of a centralized system is different from that of a messy, municipally led confederation. The second type is stable in the long run because of some dose of volatility. A scientific argument showing how tight controls backfire and cause blow-ups was made by James Clerk Maxwell of electromagnetic theory fame. Governors are contraptions meant to control the speed of steam engines by compensating for abrupt variations. They aimed at stabilizing the engines, and they apparently did. But they paradoxically sometimes brought about capricious behavior and crashes. Light control works. Close control leads to overreaction, sometimes causing the machinery to break into pieces. In a famous paper, On Governors, published in 1867, Maxwell modeled the behavior and showed mathematically that tightly controlling the speed of engines leads to instability. It is remarkable how Maxwell's neat mathematical derivations and the dangers of tight control can be generalized across domains and help debunk pseudo-stabilization and hidden long-term fragility. The financier George Cooper has revived the argument in The Origin of Financial Crises. The argument is so crisp that an old trader friend, Peter Nielsen, has distributed it to every person he knows. In the markets, fixing prices, or equivalently, eliminating speculators, the so-called noise traders, and the moderate volatility that they bring, provide an illusion of stability, with periods of calm punctuated with large jumps. Because players are unused to volatility, the slightest price variation will then be attributed to insider information, or to changes in the state of the system, and will cause panics. When a currency never varies, a slight, very slight move makes people believe that the world is ending. Injecting some confusion stabilizes the system. Indeed, confusing people a little bit is beneficial. It is good for you and good for them. For an application of the point in daily life, imagine someone extremely punctual and predictable who comes home at exactly 6 o'clock every day for 15 years. You can use his arrival to set your watch. The fellow will cause his family anxiety if he is barely a few minutes late. Someone with a slightly more volatile, hence unpredictable, schedule, with, say, a half-hour variation, won't do so. Variations also act as purges. Small forest fires periodically cleanse the system of the most flammable material, so this does not have the opportunity to accumulate. Systematically preventing forest fires from taking place to be safe makes the big ones much worse. For similar reasons, stability is not good for the economy. Firms become very weak during long periods of steady prosperity devoid of setbacks, and hidden vulnerabilities accumulate silently under the surface. So delaying crises is not a very good idea. Likewise, absence of fluctuations in the market causes hidden risks to accumulate with impunity. The longer one goes without a market trauma, the worse the damage when commotion occurs. This adverse effect of stability is straightforward to model scientifically, but when I became a trader, I was told of a heuristic used by veterans, and only old seasoned veterans. When a market reaches a new low, that is, drops to a level not seen in a long time, there is a lot of blood to come, with people rushing to the exit. Some people, unused to losing shekels, will be experiencing a large loss and will incur distress. If such a low market level has not been seen in years, say 2 years, it will be called a 2-year low and will cause more damage than a 1-year low. Tellingly, they call it a cleanup, getting the weak hands out of the way. A weak hand is clearly someone who is fragile but doesn't know it and is lulled by a false sense of security. When many such weak hands rush to the door, they collectively cause crashes. A volatile market doesn't let people go such a long time without a cleanup of risk, thereby preventing such market collapses. Fluctuat nec mergitur. Fluctuates or floats but does not sink, goes the Latin saying. Hungry donkeys. So far, we have argued that preventing randomness in an anti-fragile system is not always a good idea. Let us now look at the situation in which adding randomness has been a standard operating method, as the needed fuel for an anti-fragile system permanently hungry for it. A donkey, equally famished and thirsty, caught at an equal distance between food and water, would unavoidably die of hunger or thirst. But he can be saved thanks to a random nudge one way or the other. This metaphor is named Buridan's donkey, after the medieval philosopher Jean de Buridan, who, among other very complicated things, introduced the thought experiment. When some systems are stuck in a dangerous impasse, randomness and only randomness can unlock them and set them free. You can see here that absence of randomness equals guaranteed death. The idea of injecting random noise into a system to improve its functioning has been applied across fields. By a mechanism called stochastic resonance, adding random noise to the background makes you hear the sounds, say music, with more accuracy. We saw earlier that the psychological effect of overcompensation helps us get signals in the midst of noise. Here it is not psychological, but a physical property of the system. Weak SOS signals, too weak to get picked up by remote receptors, can become audible in the presence of background noise and random interference. By adding to the signal, random hiss allows it to rise sufficiently above the threshold of detection to become audible. Nothing in that situation does better than randomness, which comes for free. Consider the method of annealing in metallurgy, a technique used to make metal stronger and more homogeneous. It involves the heating and controlled cooling of a material to increase the size of the crystals and reduce their defects. Just as with Buridan's donkey, the heat causes the atoms to become unstuck from their initial positions and wander randomly through states of higher energy. The cooling gives them more chances of finding new, better configurations. As a child, I was exposed to a version of this annealing effect by watching my father, who is a man of habits, tap a wooden barometer every day upon coming home. He would gently strike the barometer, then get a reading for his homemade weather forecast. The stress on the barometer got the needle unstuck and allowed it to find its true equilibrium position. That's a local brand of anti-fragility. Inspired by the metallurgical technique, mathematicians use a method of computer simulation called simulated annealing, to bring more general, optimal solutions to problems and situations, solutions that only randomness can deliver. Randomness works well in search, sometimes better than humans. Nathan Myhrvold brought to my attention a controversial 1975 paper published in Science showing that random drilling was superior to whatever search method was being employed at the time. And, ironically, the so-called chaotic systems, those experiencing a brand of variations called chaos, can be stabilized by adding randomness to them. I watched an eerie demonstration of the effects, presented by a doctoral student who first got balls to jump chaotically on a table in response to steady vibrations on the surface. These steady shocks made the balls jump in a jumbled and inelegant manner. Then, as by magic, he moved a switch and the jumps became orderly and smooth. The magic is that such change of regime, from chaos to order, did not take place by removing chaos, but by adding random, completely random but low-intensity shocks. I came out of the beautiful experiment with so much enthusiasm that I wanted to inform strangers on the street, I love randomness. Political annealing. It has been hard to explain to real people that stressors and uncertainty have their role in life, so you can imagine what it would be like to explain it to politicians. Yet this is where a certain dose of randomness is needed the most. I was once shown the script of a film based on a parable of a city completely ruled by randomness, very Borgesian. At set intervals, the ruler randomly assigns to the denizens a new role in the city. Say the butcher would now become a baker, and the baker a prisoner, etc. At the end, people end up rebelling against the ruler, asking for stability as their inalienable right. I immediately thought that perhaps the opposite parable should be written. Instead of having the rulers randomize the jobs of citizens, we should have citizens randomize the jobs of rulers, naming them by raffles and removing them at random as well. That is similar to simulated annealing, and it happens to be no less effective. It turned out that the ancients, again those ancients, were aware of it. The members of the Athenian assemblies were chosen by lot, a method meant to protect the system from degeneracy. Luckily, this effect has been investigated with modern political systems. In a computer simulation, Alessandro Plucchino and his colleagues showed how adding a certain number of randomly selected politicians to the process can improve the functioning of the parliamentary system. Or sometimes the system benefits from a different type of stressors. For Voltaire, the best form of government was the one tempered with political assassination. Regicide is sort of the equivalent of tapping on the barometer to make it work better. That, too, creates some often needed reshuffling, and one that would have never been done voluntarily. The void created at the top allows the annealing effect, causing the new leader to emerge. The secular drop in premature deaths in society has deprived us of a naturalistic managerial turnover. Murder is the standard procedure for succession in the mafia. The last publicized annealing was when John Gotti murdered his predecessor in front of a New York steakhouse to become the capo of the family. Outside the mafia, bosses and board members now stay longer, a fact that impedes many domains. CEOs, tenured academics, politicians, journalists, and we need to offset this condition with random lotteries. Unfortunately, you cannot randomize a political party out of existence. What is plaguing us in the United States is not the two-party system, but being stuck with the same two parties. Parties don't have organic built-in expiration dates. Finally, the ancients perfected the method of random draw in more or less difficult situations and integrated it into divinations. These draws were really meant to pick a random exit without having to make a decision, so one would not have to live with the burden of the consequences later. You go with what the gods told you to do, so you would not have to second-guess yourself later. One of the methods, called Sortes Virgiliani, fate as decided by the epic poet Virgil, involved opening Virgil's Aeneid at random and interpreting the line that presented itself as direction for the course of action. You should use such method for every sticky business decision. I will repeat until I get hoarse. The ancients evolved hidden and sophisticated ways and tricks to exploit randomness. For instance, I actually practice such a randomizing heuristic in restaurants. Given the lengthening and complication of menus, subjecting me to what psychologists call the tyranny of choice, With a stinging feeling after my decision that I should have ordered something else, I blindly and systematically duplicate the selection by the most overweight male at the table, and when no such person is present, I randomly pick from the menu without reading the name of the item, under the peace of mind that Ball made the choice for me. That time bomb called stability. We saw that absence of fire lets highly flammable material accumulate. People are shocked and outraged when I tell them that absence of political instability, even war, lets explosive material and tendencies accumulate under the surface. The second step. Do small wars save lives? The anti-Enlightenment political philosopher Joseph de Maistre remarked that conflicts strengthen countries. This is highly debatable. War is not a good thing, and, as the victim of a brutal civil war, I can attest to its horrors. But what I find interesting and elegant in his reasoning is his pointing out the mistake of analyzing losses from a given event and ignoring the rest of the story. It is also interesting that people tend to grasp the opposite more easily, that is, spot the error of analyzing immediate gains without taking into account the long-term side effects. For we look at casualties as losses without taking into account the second step, what happens later, unlike gardeners who understand rather well that pruning trees strengthens them. Likewise, peace, some kind of forced, constrained, non-natural peace, may be costly in lives. Just consider the great complacency that led to the Great War after almost a century of relative peace in Europe, coupled with the rise of the heavily armed nation-state. Again, we all love peace, and we all love economic and emotional stability, but do not want to be suckers in the long term. We seek vaccination at every new school year, injecting ourselves with a bit of harm to build immunity, but fail to transfer the mechanism to political and economic domains. What to tell the foreign policymakers? To summarize, the problem with artificially suppressed volatility is not just that the system tends to become extremely fragile, it is that, at the same time, it exhibits no visible risks. Also remember that volatility is information. In fact, these systems tend to be too calm and exhibit minimal variability as silent risks accumulate beneath the surface. Although the stated intention of political leaders and economic policymakers is to stabilize the system by inhibiting fluctuations, the result tends to be the opposite. These artificially constrained systems become prone to black swans. Such environments eventually experience massive blow-ups of the type seen in graphic 2 of your PDF file, catching everyone off guard and undoing years of stability or, in almost all cases, ending up far worse than they were in their initial volatile state. Indeed, the longer it takes for the blow-up to occur, the worse the resulting harm to both economic and political systems. Seeking stability by achieving stability and forgetting the second step has been a great sucker game for economic and foreign policies. The list is depressingly long. Take rotten governments like the one in Egypt before the riots of 2011, supported by the United States for four decades in order to avoid chaos, with the side effect of a coterie of privileged pillagers using superpowers as a backstop, identical to bankers using their too-big-to-fail status to scam taxpayers and pay themselves high bonuses. Saudi Arabia is the country that at present worries and offends me the most. It is a standard case of top-down stability enforced by a superpower at the expense of every single possible moral and ethical metric, and, of course, at the expense of stability itself. So a place allied to the United States is a total monarchy, devoid of a constitution. But that is not what is morally shocking. A group of between 7 and 15,000 members of the royal family runs the place, leading a lavish, hedonistic lifestyle in open contradiction with the purest ideas that got them there. Look at the contradiction. The stern desert tribes whose legitimacy is derived from Amish-like austerity can, thanks to a superpower, turn to hedonistic, uninhibited pleasure-seeking. The king openly travels for pleasure with a retinue that fills four jumbo jets. Quite a departure from his ancestors. the family members amassed a fortune now largely in Western safes. Without the United States, the country would have had its revolution, a regional breakup, some turmoil, then perhaps, by now, some stability. But preventing noise makes the problem worse in the long run. Clearly, the alliance between the Saudi royal family and the United States was meant to provide stability. What stability? How long can one confuse the system? Actually, how long is irrelevant. This stability is similar to a loan one has to eventually pay back. And there are ethical issues I leave to Chapter 24, particularly casuistry, when someone finds a justification for the sake of to violate an otherwise inflexible moral rule. Note these double standards on the part of Western governments. As a Christian, parts of Saudi Arabia are off-limits to me, as I would violate the purity of the place. But no public part of the United States or Western Europe is off-limits to Saudi citizens. Few people are aware of the fact that the bitterness of Iranians toward the United States comes from the fact that the United States, a democracy, installed a monarch, the repressive Shah of Iran, who pillaged the place but gave the United States the stability of access to the Persian Gulf. The theocratic regime in Iran today is largely the result of such repression. We need to learn to think in second steps, chains of consequences, and side effects. More worrisome, U.S. policy toward the Middle East has historically, and especially since September 11, 2001, been unduly focused on the repression of any and all political fluctuations in the name of preventing Islamic fundamentalism, a trope that almost every regime has used. Aside from the fact that killing Islamists compounds their numbers, the West and its autocratic Arab allies have strengthened Islamic fundamentalists by forcing them underground. Time for American policymakers to understand that the more they intervene in other countries for the sake of stability, the more they bring instability, except for emergency room-style cases. Or perhaps time to reduce the role of policymakers in policy affairs. One of life's packages, no stability without volatility. What do we call here modernity? My definition of modernity is humans' large-scale domination of the environment, the systematic smoothing of the world's jaggedness, and the stifling of volatility and stressors. Modernity corresponds to the systematic extraction of humans from their randomness-laden ecology, physical and social, even epistemological. Modernity is not just the post-medieval, post-agrarian, and post-feudal historical period as defined in sociology textbooks. It is rather the spirit of an age marked by rationalization, naive rationalism, the idea that society is understandable, hence must be designed, by humans. With it was born statistical theory, hence the beastly bell curve. So was linear science. So was the notion of efficiency, or optimization. Modernity is a Procrustean bed, good or bad, a reduction of humans to what appears to be efficient and useful. Some aspects of it work. Procrustean beds are not all negative reductions. Some may be beneficial, though these are rare. Consider the life of the lion in the comfort and predictability of the Bronx Zoo, with Sunday afternoon visitors flocking to look at him in a combination of curiosity, awe, and pity, compared to that of his cousins in freedom. We, at some point, had free-range humans and free-range children before the advent of the golden period of the soccer mom. We are moving into a phase of modernity marked by the lobbyist, the very, very limited liability corporation, the MBA, soccer problems, secularization, or rather reinvention of new sacred values like flags to replace altars, the tax man, fear of the boss, spending the weekend in interesting places and the work week in a putatively less interesting one, the separation of work and leisure, though the two would look identical to someone from a wiser era, the retirement plan, argumentative intellectuals who would disagree with this definition of modernity, literal thinking, inductive inference, philosophy of science, the invention of social science, smooth surfaces, and egocentric architects. Violence is transferred from individuals to states. So is financial indiscipline. At the center of all this is the denial of anti-fragility. There is a dependence on narratives, an intellectualization of actions and ventures. Public enterprises and functionaries, even employees of large corporations, can only do things that seem to fit some narrative, unlike businesses that can just follow profits, with or without a well-sounding story. Remember that you need a name for the color blue when you build a narrative, but not in action. The thinker lacking a word for blue is handicapped, not the doer. I've had a hard time conveying to intellectuals the intellectual superiority of practice. Modernity widened the difference between the sensational and the relevant. In a natural environment, the sensational is, well, sensational for a reason. Today, we depend on the press for such essentially human things as gossip and anecdotes, and we care about the private lives of people in very remote places. Indeed, in the past, when we were not fully aware of anti-fragility and self-organization and spontaneous healing, we managed to respect these properties by constructing beliefs that served the purpose of managing and surviving uncertainty. We imparted improvements to the agency of gods. We may have denied that things can take care of themselves without some agency, but it was the gods that were the agents, not Harvard-educated captains of the ship. So the emergence of the nation-state falls squarely into this progression, the transfer of agency to mere humans. The story of the nation-state is that of the concentration and magnification of human errors. Modernity starts with the state monopoly on violence and ends with the state's monopoly on fiscal irresponsibility. We will discuss next two central elements at the core of modernity. Primo, in Chapter 7, naive interventionism, with the costs associated with fixing things that one should leave alone. Secundo, in Chapter 8 and as a transition to Book 3, this idea of replacing God and the gods running future events with something even more religiously fundamentalist, the unconditional belief in the idea of scientific prediction, regardless of the domain, the aim to squeeze the future into numerical reductions, whether reliable or unreliable. For we have managed to transfer religious belief into gullibility for whatever can masquerade as science. Chapter 7. An Introduction to Naive Intervention and Iatrogenics, the Most Neglected Product of Modernity. Noise and Signal and Over-Intervening from Noise. Naive Intervention. A tonsillectomy to kill time. Never do today what can be left to tomorrow. Let's predict revolutions after they happen. Lessons in Blackjack. Consider this need to do something through an illustrative example. In the 1930s, 389 children were presented to New York City doctors. 174 of them were recommended tonsillectomies. The remaining 215 children were again presented to doctors, and 99 were said to need the surgery. When the remaining 116 children were shown to yet a third set of doctors, 52 were recommended the surgery. Note that morbidity exists in 2-4% of the cases, today, not then, as the risks of surgery were very bad at the time, and that a death occurs in about every 15,000 such operations, and you get an idea about the break-even point between medical gains and detriment. This story allows us to witness probabilistic homicide at work. Every child who undergoes an unnecessary operation has a shortening of her life expectancy. This example not only gives us an idea of harm done by those who intervene, but, worse, it illustrates the lack of awareness of the need to look for a break-even point between benefits and harm. Let us call this urge to help naive interventionism. Next, we examine its costs. Intervention and iatrogenics. In the case of tonsillectomies, the harm to the children undergoing unnecessary treatment is coupled with a trumpeted gain for some others. The name for such net loss, the usually hidden or delayed damage from treatment in excess of the benefits, is iatrogenics, literally caused by the healer, iatros being a healer in Greek. We will posit in Chapter 21 that every time you visit a doctor and get a treatment, you incur risks of such medical harm, which should be analyzed the way we analyze other trade-offs, probabilistic benefits minus probabilistic costs. For a classic example of iatrogenics, consider the death of George Washington in December 1799. We have enough evidence that his doctors greatly helped, or at least hastened, his death, thanks to the then standard treatment that included bloodletting, between 5 and 9 pounds of blood. Now, these risks of harm by the healer can be so overlooked that, depending on how you account for it, until penicillin, medicine had a largely negative balance sheet. Going to the doctor increased your chance of death. But it is quite telling that medical iatrogenics seems to have increased over time, along with knowledge, to peak sometime late in the 19th century. Thank you, modernity. It was scientific progress, the birth of the clinic and its substitution for home remedies, that caused death rates to shoot up, mostly from what was then called hospital fever. Leibniz had called these hospitals seminaria mortis, seedbeds of death. The evidence of increase in death rates is about as strong as they come, since all the victims were now gathered in one place. People were dying in these institutions who would have survived outside them. The famously mistreated Austro-Hungarian doctor Ignaz Semmelweis had observed that more women died giving birth in hospitals than giving birth on the street. He called the establishment doctors a bunch of criminals, which they were. The doctors who kept killing patients could not accept his facts or act on them, since he had no theory for his observations. Semmelweis entered a state of depression, helpless to stop what he saw as murders, disgusted at the attitude of the establishment. He ended up in an asylum, where he died, ironically, from the same hospital fever he had been warning against. Semmelweis's story is sad. A man who was punished, humiliated, and even killed for shouting the truth in order to save others. The worst punishment was his state of helplessness in the face of risks and unfairness. But the story is also a happy one. The truth came out eventually, and his mission ended up paying off, with some delay. And the final lesson is that one should not expect laurels for bringing the truth. Medicine is comparatively the good news, perhaps the only good news, in the field of iatrogenics. We see the problem there because things are starting to be brought under control today. It is now just what we call the cost of doing business, although medical error still currently kills between 3 times, as accepted by doctors, and 10 times as many people as car accidents in the United States. It is generally accepted that harm from doctors, not including risks from hospital germs, accounts for more deaths than any single cancer. The methodology used by the medical establishment for decision-making is still innocent of proper risk management principles, but medicine is getting better. We have to worry about the incitation to over-treatment on the part of pharmaceutical companies, lobbies, and special interest groups, and the production of harm that is not immediately salient and not accounted for as an error. Pharma plays the game of concealed and distributed iatrogenics, and it has been growing. It is easy to assess iatrogenics when the surgeon amputates the wrong leg or operates on the wrong kidney, or when the patient dies of a drug reaction. But when you medicate a child for an imagined or invented psychiatric disease, say ADHD or depression, instead of letting him out of the cage, the long-term harm is largely unaccounted for. Iatrogenics is compounded by the agency problem, or principal-agent problem, which emerges when one party, the agent, has personal interests that are divorced from those of the one using his services, the principal. An agency problem, for instance, is present with the stockbroker and medical doctor, whose ultimate interest is their own checking account, not your financial and medical health, respectively, and who give you advice that is geared to benefit themselves. Or with politicians working on their career. First, do no harm. Medicine has known about iatrogenics since at least the 4th century before our era. Primum non nocere, first do no harm, is a first principle attributed to Hippocrates and integrated in the so-called Hippocratic Oath taken by every medical doctor on his commencement day. It just took medicine about 24 centuries to properly execute the brilliant idea. In spite of the recitations of Non Nocere through the ages, the term iatrogenics only appeared in frequent use very, very late, a few decades ago, after so much damage had been done. I, for myself, did not know the exact word until the writer Brian Appleyard introduced me to it. I had used harmful, unintended side effects. So let us leave medicine, to return to it in a dozen chapters or so, and apply this idea born in medicine to other domains of life. Since no intervention implies no iatrogenics, the source of harm lies in the denial of anti-fragility and to the impression that we humans are so necessary to making things function. Enforcing consciousness of generalized iatrogenics is a tall order. The very notion of iatrogenics is quite absent from the discourse outside medicine, which, to repeat, has been a rather slow learner. But just as with the color blue, having a word for something helps spread awareness of it. We will push the idea of iatrogenics into political science, economics, urban planning, education, and more domains. Not one of the consultants and academics in these fields with whom I tried discussing it knew what I was talking about, or thought that they could possibly be the source of any damage. In fact, when you approach the players with such skepticism, they tend to say that you are against scientific progress. But the concept can be found in some religious texts. The Quran mentions those who are wrongful while thinking of themselves that they are righteous. To sum up, anything in which there is naive interventionism, nay, even just intervention, will have iatrogenics. The opposite of iatrogenics. While we now have a word for causing harm while trying to help, we don't have a designation for the opposite situation, that of someone who ends up helping while trying to cause harm. Just remember that attacking the anti-fragile will backfire. For instance, hackers make systems stronger. Or, as in the case of Ayn Rand, obsessive and intense critics help a book spread. Incompetence is double-sided. In the Mel Brooks movie The Producers, two New York theater fellows get in trouble by finding success instead of the intended failure. They had sold the same shares to multiple investors in a Broadway play, reasoning that should the play fail, they would keep the excess funds. Their scheme would not be discovered if the investors got no return on their money. The problem was that they tried so hard to have a bad play, called Springtime for Hitler, and they were so bad at it that it turned out to be a huge hit. Uninhibited by their common prejudices, they managed to produce interesting work. I also saw similar irony in trading. A fellow was so upset with his year-end bonus that he started making huge bets with his employer's portfolio, and ended up making them considerable sums of money. More than if he had tried to do so on purpose. Perhaps the idea behind capitalism is an inverse iatrogenic effect, the unintended but not so unintended consequences. The system facilitates the conversion of selfish aims, or, to be correct, not necessarily benevolent ones, at the individual level into beneficial results for the collective. Iatrogenics in high places. Two areas have been particularly infected with absence of awareness of iatrogenics: socioeconomic life and, as we just saw in the story of Semmelweis, the human body, matters in which we have historically combined a low degree of competence with a high rate of intervention and a disrespect for spontaneous operation and healing, let alone growth and improvement. As we saw in Chapter 3, there is a distinction between organisms, biological or non-biological, and machines. People with an engineering-oriented mind will tend to look at everything around as an engineering problem. This is a very good thing in engineering, but when dealing with cats, it is a much better idea to hire veterinarians than circuits engineers. Or even better, let your animal heal by itself. Graphic 3 in your PDF file provides a glimpse of these attempts to improve matters across domains and their effects. Note the obvious. In all cases, they correspond to the denial of anti-fragility. Can a whale fly like an eagle? Social scientists and economists have no built-in consciousness of iatrogenics, and of course no name for it. When I decided to teach a class on model error in economics and finance, nobody took me or the idea seriously, and the few who did tried to block me, asking for a theory, as in Semmelweis's story, and not realizing that it was precisely the errors of theory that I was addressing and cataloging, as well as the very idea of using a theory without considering the impact of the possible errors from theory. For a theory is a very dangerous thing to have. And of course, one